From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the November 2014 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. With only a couple of weeks to go to the general release of The Imitation Game, we can now bring you more exclusive interviews from the cast and crew. Our roving reporter, Astrid Speck, kindly braved the rain to chat to some of the patient fans in Leicester Square at last month's London Film Festival premiere, while podcast host Catherine Lynch sat down with screenwriter Graham Moore, director Morton Tilden, and the actors Matthew Beard and Alan Leach.
That's what you're doing here, the top secret programme at Bletchley. You're trying to break the German Enigma machine.
What makes you think that?
It's the greatest encryption device in history, and the Germans use it for all major communications. If the Allies broke Enigma, well, it would turn into a very short war indeed.
Of course, that's what you're working on. But you also haven't got anywhere with it. If you had, you wouldn't be hiring cryptographers out of university.
You need me a lot more than I need you. I like solving problems, Commander. And Enigma is the most difficult problem in the world.
No, Enigma isn't difficult, it's impossible. The Americans, the Russians, the French, the Germans, everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Good. Let me try, and we'll know for sure, won't we?
I love the whole story of Bletchley Park, the code breaking in World War II, the fact that people were pulled in from every walk of life, finding people who never would have made a contribution except through this amazing place, and it's how we won World War II.
When did you first hear about Alan Turing?
I only heard about Alan Turing very recently, I think when Gordon Brown finally pardoned him. His story is just so amazing and tragic. And after the war, he was so badly treated with the criminal prosecution for his homosexuality, the chemical castration, and ultimately his suicide. The fact that his contribution is only just being recognized is amazing and so important.
So you happy that this film has been made then?
Oh, extremely happy. And anything with Benedict Cumberbatch in, I'm going to watch.
Yeah, we just got harassed for being stupid.
A woman came in and made us do times tables. It's very disconcerting when you do that to someone, isn't it?
They're supposed to be mathematicians.
I know, this is it.
Well, we're actors.
Oh, thereabouts,
supposed
yeah.
To play mathematicians.
Well, obviously, what I want to know primarily is what it was like filming at Bletchley Park.
It was incredible filming at Bletchley Park. I think it's such a rare thing to be able to go to the actual real buildings and see the real huts and everything else. I'd already done a little research trip to Bletchley Park and rinsed all the resident mathematicians there for information, and they tried their hardest to explain to me, but most of it went over my head. but it was great just to see all the replica bomb they have there and everything else. So it was great just to be within those walls, I think.
Do you get a sense of atmosphere of what it was like?
That's exactly what I was about to say. You almost feel that you can feel the presence of all those incredible minds when you walk into to the main building in Bletchley Park, and where we filmed, you know, the bar. You could all of us felt that, you know, the hairs stand on end on our necks when we went in there, because, you know, I'm pretty sure if you dusted that place, you'll still find the fingerprints of everyone that we played there somewhere. So, you know, it also brought home the responsibility we felt in portraying these characters and telling Alan Turing's story and telling it to the very best of our ability, and, you know, really bringing to life, you know, a story that people really don't know and really should know about this incredible man and the incredible work done at Bletchley Park.
And what do you think this story, because it's one of those cases where truth is slightly stranger than fiction, I think. What do you think it tells us about Britain at that time?
I think it tells us a lot. Well, it's Britain at different times, obviously. I think after the war, I think the way Alan Turing was treated tells us a lot about Britain at that time, but perhaps not good things. And the fact that he was only pardoned very recently says a lot of worrying things about Britain. But the efforts within the hut and the war effort and the genius minds we had at Oxford and Cambridge that they gathered together in that hut also is a great celebration of academia in this country and what we achieved. So I think there's a lot going on in the film, and both good and bad in that sense.
And when you were researching your characters, you must have felt quite a sense, you mentioned it, Alan, a sense of responsibility, because you're playing someone real and they're within living memory for some people. So tell me about the research you did. And
well, there are some incredible books written not only about Bletchley Park or about Alan Turing, but about John Cairncross and about Peter Hilton, and they exist. So, you know, it's trying to find that balance between telling, you know, at the end of the day, you're telling a story within a time frame of 2 hours in a movie. And you find the balance between truth, as much as you can garner, and the information that you can have within your own head of who these people were. And then, you know, within the constraints of a script as well. So it's finding that balance of where you pitch yourself.
Hmm. I think we're in a phase culturally somehow, and I'd like your opinions on why this is. It seems to be quite cool to be clever. What do you think's contributed to that?
Well, I think Matthew Beard is a perfect example of how being clever, and you can still be cool as long as you grow a beard.
Yeah. I'm not sure why that's culturally. I think maybe in a way it might have something to do with the kind of the equivalents of Alan Turing we have now, which are digital, you know, Mark Zuckerbergs and people like that, internet business minds. Mm. And their kind of mythology around them and the sort of startup Silicon Valley and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of cool to be creating apps and all that sort of stuff now. So I think there is an element of that. Also, the rise of the nerd is the thing I've heard many times now, in terms of supposedly having glasses and being skinny is back in fashion, which is great for me because I've always been skinny and just been waiting.
And had bad eyesight.
And bad eyesight. Yeah. I'm just waiting for the moment where I'm in fashion and finally it's arrived.
Yeah, but the window is probably about 4 months, so enjoy it.
Before alpha male hunks take over again. Yeah. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I can't stop that. Thank you.
I think it's really fantastic that, what is it now, 60 or 70 years after his death, that we finally have something that's going to bring to the attention of the world the story of Alan Turing. I think most people probably have no idea that he's basically the father of modern thought program computing, and he was just an amazing guy. So I think it's fantastic that finally people are going to know about him. Obviously, because of the Official Secrets Act, a lot of stuff that he did was never recognized in his lifetime by anybody other than the people that he worked with. So I think this is just, it's just wonderful that people are going to be able to see what a, like, national treasure the guy is.
Have you been to Bletchley Park?
I have, yeah. It's fantastic. Everybody go.
What did you love most about it?
I actually really loved the bomb rebuild. It was amazing to see the thing actually working. I have no idea how it works, but it just the ingenuity that it must have taken to construct that thing in the first place, I think that was amazing. I love the statue of Alan. You can see where these people worked and, like, what they did. You can see Alan's cup chained to his radiator. It's obviously not his cup, but you get a real sense of what the atmosphere might have been like when people were working there. And it's just a beautiful place. It's a lovely day out, and it's really quick to get to as well from the city.
Why do you think it's now the time that The Imitation Game could be filmed and Alan Turing's story could be told?
I think he's just a real character. I read an anecdote whereby he used to run everywhere, apparently, and he was running to his friend's house, and he got there, received no answer at the door. I don't know if it was the middle of the night or not. So decided to grab a leaf and start to scratch a dinner invitation onto this leaf, with possibly a twig, I don't know, and push it through the letterbox. I think he's just an incredible character.
So what appealed to you about this story?
I mean, I was sent this script by my agent and said, this is a beautiful script, you need to read this. And what appealed to me is that I didn't, how little I knew about it. I was shocked that these great achievements that this man did and what happened at Bletchley was things I didn't know about. And you know, I needed to research more. I needed to find out more about this. And why wasn't this, you know, front cover of every history book? Because it's such an important impact. It had such an important impact on the world. And it's also this sort of like the man who was the forefather of the computer. So to me, it became, I wanted to spread his legacy and try to, you know, tell the story of this man. And it's a story about outsiders. It's a story about those who think differently, who didn't fit in, and how important it is to have them and sort of like celebrate them instead of prosecuting them.
And what was it like when you filmed at Bletchley Park? How important was that?
It was tremendously important. I mean, our working together with Bletchley Park has been great, and it was really helpful to us to have to have access, first of all, the research and all the help in trying to making this movie as accurate as possible. And we wanted to, you know, that we have been able to shoot part of the movie at Bletchley Park. I think it was very emotional for all the actors and for all the crew to be there, that this is where it actually happened. This is where, you know, it took place. And at the same time as we shot at the school that he went to. So we wanted to shoot as much as possible at the locations where Alan Turing's life happened. And also that just the fact that all the enigmas in the film are the actual enigmas from the war. I remember all the actors were shocked when we brought in the enigma for the first time and just touch it and, you know, just see it there. And then it's a great reminder that this actually happened. This was, you know, in a time where, you know, this helped save so many people, and it was such an important time, important for the war. So I think that having as much authenticity, having, you know, props, equipment, everything borrowed for Bletchley was very important.
I expect you read up on some of the veterans' own accounts of what happened. What sort of came out to you as what the atmosphere was like at Bletchley Park?
It's what we're trying to say. Like, this is, there was a place where these first of all, the groups of people at Hut 8 was this kind of like eclectic group of chess players, you know, crossword puzzles, mathematicians, and how unique they were, and also the pressure that everyone was on, you know, how serious they took it, and how, you know, extreme hard they worked, and also how many people who were there, like this buzzy bee feeling of when everybody took it so important, everybody worked so hard, and we're trying to portray that, and, you know, and just a staggering amount of paperwork and how big this whole machinery had to be to organize this. So it's always a challenge, you know, when you're trying to portray something that how it was and then trying to make it into a movie but it was important for us to try and recreate the spirit of how it was, must have felt to be at Bletchley at that time. And also there was, you know, it was young people who were there. They were, you know, most of them were between 18 and 23, 24 years old who was there. And how important it was for them to let off some steam and get drunk and get crazy, you know, because they were all working so hard and there was so much pressure on them. And not only that, but and how everybody kept secret about it, how this was, you know, one of the best kept secrets.
It's a gift at that age. You think you can conquer the world, and they kind of did. This film, as you've said, celebrates otherness, difference, and it seems to be that being clever is becoming quite cool now. What do you think's made that happen? What do you think's contributed to that?
That's a tough one. I think that it is a time now that somebody, I mean, look at what we're carrying around us. The computer and our digital devices are so important to us. And making a movie who celebrates Alan Turing, who sort of like was a forefather of that, who actually visioned all of this, is become so important. And I think that we are at a time actually where it's, as you said, that we now can celebrate those who are the technician, the math genius, those who are, you know, inventing and have and can think new ideas and new thoughts.
What are you most proud of about this film?
Oh.
Difficult to pick one thing, but...
I know. I'm very proud of the performances. I'm very proud that actually I think we managed to portray the spirit of Alan Turing and the spirit of Bletchley, what it must have felt like, and the sheer pressure they must have experienced, and also the great achievement that actually did, and how important they were for the outcome of the war. And I'm proud of that.
Lovely. Thank you.
I recently visited Bletchley Park after hearing about Benedict receiving the role. I have to be honest, I've never heard of Alan Turing before then. I lived quite local to Bletchley Park as well, but I'd never really took the opportunity to go because I didn't know what it was about. And it got me more into an insight about what the story's like. So it's quite nice now coming to this, knowing a little bit more about a lot more than what I did before now. And so I feel like it's going to be like exciting to see it all put together in a film to try and tell the story.
When you started to read up on the story,
yeah,
what is it you found most interesting?
It was definitely the code breaking. I mean, you know, it's such a relevant part to things that we have now. And definitely the story of Alan Turing needs to be broadcasted and told. And I think doing it this way brings in a new audience and a lot more accessible.
Sometimes films take artistic liberty.
Yes. Oh, definitely.
But at least it gets the story out there.
It enables people to then go out further and think, oh, that sounded good. I'll read behind it now.
I would like to think that people would come away from the film thinking, I want to know more.
Yeah.
I think it's going to have that.
I think it's going to be that type of film as well.
Why do you think Alan Turing's story is important?
He holds a special place in history, and you know, everyone else has got that limelight, so why hasn't he?
He's been pardoned, hasn't
he?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
It's about time the guy got some recognition.
Exactly.
And by putting it in a popular forum like this, that's what it's about.
Yeah. It's an incredible story on so many different levels, and it is such an important part of our history. So at the end of the day, he and his team saved millions of lives. And how it's been ignored for so long, essentially,
living his life the way he wanted to.
Yeah. He was human. He's not, you know, he is modern day. He is a superhero. Everybody wants Benedict Cumberbatch to play a superhero. He is.
Graham, how important was it to film at Bletchley Park?
Oh, it was crucial, and we always knew that, you know, this is a true story, and in paying tribute to Alan Turing and in paying tribute to all of the men and women at Bletchley Park, accuracy was sort of foremost in our minds, and the responsibility of telling the story and doing justice to all these people was foremost on our minds. So shooting at Bletchley Park was very important to that. From our first visits, you know, years before we started shooting, and even for me as a writer, just to walk around, walk down those paths and be in those buildings and to sort of feel that, we wanted the movie to have that sense too.
What sense of atmosphere did you get from visiting and walking around, perhaps unnoticed even in the early days of your research? What sense of what it was like during World War II did you get?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when you walk around Bletchley Park, you realize, you know, as filmmakers, we realize the responsibility of the task at hand at telling the story and doing justice to it. And then just as a person, you realize what these people were able to accomplish with such sort of meager support and meager resources at their hands. You know, Bletchley wasn't a glamorous work environment. I mean, these people were able to, with very little resources, accomplish wonders, and was tremendous and set the bar very high for us as filmmakers.
How did you get into the subject in the first place? What was it that drew you to write about Alan Turing?
Oh, you know, I had been obsessed with the story of Alan Turing since I was a teenager. I was this huge computer nerd as a kid. I went to computer programming camp. I went to space camp. I'd always wanted to write about him, to tell his story on screen. And over the years, I kept sort of hoping someone would make like a proper Alan Turing film, like a sort of a proper biopic. And as, you know, just as a fan of films, as someone who wanted to see that story. And I feel so lucky that I, you know, years later got to be one of the people to get to do it.
And this is your first film, isn't it?
It is. It's my first film. It was my first time on a film set. I'd never done any of this before. So
you jumped right in at the top then, didn't you? This is a big one.
It feels that way now. It would be very funny on set. Morton would tease me, and he would joke about all the words I didn't know and all the acronyms and all the sort of film terms that he'd quiz me sometimes in the morning. He'd be like, Graham, do you know what it means? The blah, blah, blah. And I'd be like, no. And he'd be like, it means whatever filmmaking thing. And it was, you know, a tremendous responsibility to tell this story on screen, especially as my first film. It was, you know, it was a lot of sleepless nights and a lot of making sure that we really had a handle on it to do it properly.
What do you hope people will come away thinking or knowing about Alan Turing?
I think that, you know, we like to think of our film as a tribute to people who are different, as a tribute to people who, for whatever reason, do not fit into the societal mainstream. I think that was Turing's story for so many reasons. He was one of the most brilliant mathematicians of the 20th century. He was a war hero. He was a gay man at a time when that was not something that was speakable in polite society. And he was someone who, despite his differences, managed to accomplish wonders that no one else could have. And that's something that I think, you know, resonates even today.
And of course, to make a film work in dramatic terms, you have to veer from the truth. It's not a documentary. It's a completely different way of telling a story. Did that element of it give you sleepless nights as to how to make that work?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it was a tremendous responsibility of knowing this was a true story. And, you know, paying tribute to Alan Turing was something that we needed to do with great care and great consideration. And, you know, it's such an amazing story that every time, you know, when I describe it to people, when I tell people what really happened, they'd be like, oh, well, you must have made that up. There's no way that's true. And it's like the most fantastic parts of the story are absolutely true. It's you would never believe it if someone, you know, didn't have proof that it really happened.
That's right. I would agree with that. You couldn't make it up. Would you feel, after your experience of making this film and researching this story, do you feel it's important to keep Bletchley Park alive?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think as a tribute to the people who were there and as a piece of history that people should be aware of and should visit and should see and should take part of, I think, you know, the world around us has been made possible thanks to Bletchley Park, and that's something that we should never forget.
6 minutes. Is that even possible?
No. It takes me 8. This isn't about crossword puzzles. It's about how one approaches solving an impossible problem. Do you tackle the whole thing at once or divide it into small? You finished?
Yes.
Five minutes and 34 seconds.
You said to do it in under 6.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, your Amex insider, and I'm here in London's Leicester Square for the opening night gala of the BFI Film Festival in partnership with American Express. This is The Imitation Game. Opening the BFI London Film Festival must be quite a thrill for you.
It's always lovely to sort of have a premiere on home turf, and especially given that this is a very typically British film about a very important part of British history, it feels very nice to be here tonight.
This has been a project that everyone I ask say yes, so I get my first pick for everything, and everybody wants to be part of this, everybody wants to be part of tell this story about this remarkable and fascinating man, so it's been such a privilege to work with like the top British talent.
Well, here I am, windswept, with Benedict Cumberbatch. Tell me about this film, because what a character to get your teeth into.
To be doing my job, let alone to then be asked to play such a phenomenal human being, a true English hero, is a great honour. It comes with a responsibility. His legacy is very precious to me, so I really hope you've done him justice and that this brings his story and achievements to a wider audience.
The thing that I found most interesting about Turing was that he shortened the war, saved millions of lives, and the fact that the Enigma code was, the reason it was so difficult was because it reset itself every 24 hours. So that was what made it so difficult, and the fact he did it is extraordinary.
Can I just say to everyone who's out here, thank you very, very much for supporting the film. I'm sorry I can't come around and say hello to every single one of you, but I adore you. I'm really, really grateful for your support, and I hope you enjoy the film.
If you join the Friends of Bletchley Park by the 27th of November, you'll receive a special edition of the Bletchley Park magazine, Behind the Lens. It takes you behind the scenes during filming of The Imitation Game and speaks to Benedict about how shooting scenes at Bletchley Park helped him get into character. To find out how to join, just go to bletchleypark.org.uk and look under the Support Us tab. In next month's podcast, we'll be taking you to the opening of our new exhibit, The Imitation Game at Bletchley Park, which launches with a special screening of the film on November the 4th and then opens to the public on the 10th. Also, you'll hear our exclusive podcast interview with Benedict. But for now, we wanted to share something very special with you. As Catherine sat down to start her interview with Benedict, all of us at Bletchley Park were genuinely touched by what was foremost in his mind.
What did you think?
Are we ready?
What did you think?
Yes, we're on air.
Oh, fantastic.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes, very much.
Oh, good.
Brilliant.
Did, well done. Have lots of Bletchley Park people seen it yet? Or
yes. Yeah, everybody loves it.
Yes?
Yes, yes.
Oh, that's such a relief. That's such a relief.
Just finally, how yes. important is it, do you think, that Bletchley Park is kept alive and accessible to people?
Hugely important. Hugely important. I mean, that was the environment where men and women from all walks of society, from all abilities, whether it be actors and artists to the more likely candidates of mathematicians and physicists and scientific thinkers, came together to try and crack a code that was basically, or many codes actually, that were the encryption devices of the Nazis, and they were winning the war. The country was starving, the clock was ticking, as is portrayed in the sort of pacing thriller element of our film. And to understand the importance of that is also to understand the importance of those men and women and the actual environments of where it happened. So to experience something of that through the extraordinary exhibits and explanations you get, both of the working environment and the tools, the actual, you can see the machine, you can hear the machine working, one of the earliest computers working, and it's amazing. You think from that came a reading of a code that basically won us the war, the Second World War, some estimate by 2 years, and that meant millions of lives were saved. And it was all done in secret, and now we can look at that secret. So how could that not be one of the most important legacies we have in our culture of that era? It's incredibly important that it keeps going, incredibly important that it's open to the public and something that's well-funded and supported and continues, because this is our history.
When Bletchley Park historian and guide Joel Greenberg recently gave a talk on his biography of Gordon Welshman, there was a very special guest in attendance. Lord Asa Briggs served at Bletchley Park from 1942 till 1945, working with Welshman in Hut 6 and then later in Block D. He spoke to the sold-out audience about his time at the Government Code and Cipher School.
We have a special guest today. It's my great pleasure to introduce Lord Asa Briggs. Asa was actually a colleague of mine at the Open University many years ago. Well, a colleague, he was a chancellor. I was just a humble employee. Asa worked in Hut 6. He knew Gordon well. That's a real honor, and I'm delighted that he's able to come. And when Asa was launching one of his books, My Secret Days, and if you remember this, about 3 years ago, I met you and I talked, and I told you that I was writing Gordon's biography, and you looked so delighted. Little did I know that in your book, when I read it, you bemoaned and despaired at the fact that no one had been inspired to write Welshman's biography. So I'm delighted that I'm able to do it. So I'd like you to put your hands together and welcome Lord Briggs, who's going to say a few words.
May I say how delighted I am to have listened to what we've been told about the new biography of Gordon Welshman. I always felt that he and Turing were two great men who deserved really good biographies. And I've learnt more from Joe's book than I expected to do. I should say that I realised after reading it that I didn't know Gordon quite as well as I thought that I had once done. There are lots of things about him that I learnt from the book, and they're all fascinating. I was horrified to learn of the ridiculous actions of the then head of GCHQ, Maryport, which I think were ignominious and should be referred to always in those terms forever. I also feel myself that I didn't know anywhere near enough about the troubles that Gordon has had in publishing Hut 6 story. I also read it immediately when it came out, and it seemed to me to be a very true account of what life had been like in Hut 6. we were a team. Not one person, including Gordon himself, dominated it. The whole of success of Bletchley lay in the teamwork on the part of many people, including lots and lots of women. And I think we should always ensure that when we tell the Bletchley story, that women are really given a very prominent part in it. There are certain things I've come to the conclusion about after reading your book, is that Gordon was not particularly attached to Sidney Sussex College, where I was an undergraduate. He was much more involved with Marlborough, to which he sent his son. And Marlborough was one of the places from which Bletchley recruited many cryptographers during the war, some of them very young. And in Joel's book, he shows how some cryptographers were much better than others. And I'm glad that he's paid tribute to the man I thought was the brightest of the cryptographers I came across in Hut 6, was Nigel Forward. My evaluations of Bletchley change a bit with the years. I find out new things, but my love of the place is intensely strong still. When I passed the lake this afternoon, I thought it's lovely to see the lake on a bright sunny day, and there are many non-bright sunny days in Bletchley. I also thought of all the haunts of mine when I was in Bletchley Park, and I did manage to do one thing then, right at the end of the war, which I don't think it would be possible to do in present circumstances. I actually wrote a book when I moved into the camp. That was a very important step. The camp played its own part in the history of Bletchley, and the commandant, Colonel Fillinger, was not allowed to come into Bletchley Park at all, and this infuriated him. He liked me, and he told me on a famous occasion when I saw him for the last time, it was late at night, it was right against all the army rules. He said, "Asa, there's one thing that you should do in your life, is to beware the insidious influence of women." I found this rather curious advice to be given in the war. But the war itself, as I said, produced cryptographers of considerable diversity. And there's only one thing that I really found to be wrong in Joel's book, and it's to me, naturally, rather an important passage. He said, "Non-mathematicians were also recruited from Sidney Sussex, including Howard Smith and Asa Briggs." Now, Howard Smith would have been appalled to have himself described as a non-mathematician. I knew him in Bletchley when he went over almost immediately at the end of the war with Gordon, and he had, of course, a most remarkable career in intelligence. And I feel, therefore, that when I think about Bletchley at my age, I think about the characters who were there in terms of their whole lives. I never expected my life to be so long. I think about what happened to them after Bletchley. And it's interesting that Howard, as I've said, I knew him before he came to Bletchley, because I had 1 year in Sidney Sussex College, which now looks to be a bit like an intelligence agency. And I saw that my history tutor, Jim Passant, was on that list of men of the university type. I was never taught by Jim because the war intervened, but when he took me to Sidney Sussex College, he said, "You're only a baby, but I'm taking you because there'll be a war, and I want to feel that you're ready prepared for it, and learn some German at all costs. He went on to become the librarian of the Foreign Office. And the Foreign Office had a tremendous amount to do with Bletchley during the war. I admired Turing immensely. There's one person that I now feel should have his biography written. Tilghman, a great cryptographer, very, very little known, whose cryptographic career went back long before Bletchley. And he, being then a brigadier, was the person who welcomed me to Bletchley, not Gordon. And I found that he understood me well. Why not just mathematicians, but historians were important through their ability to get inside the minds of the people who were sending the messages. And that kind of empathy was crucial to cribbing and getting the messages through. I'm delighted, Joel, that your book has appeared, and I look forward to keeping in close touch with you in the future. Thank you very much.
After a book signing session, Lord Briggs sat down with me for a reflective conversation.
I'm delighted to be back in the house, Bletchley Park, which I've known for a very long time indeed, and the history of which I've studied before there's anybody from Bletchley here at all, the story of the Montefiore family. It's an eccentric house, and my memory of Bletchley as the years go by tends to concentrate myself on eccentrics who were here. And one of the biggest of them was Josh Cooper, who moved on to GCHQ. In my new book, which has just come out, which is called Loose Ends and Extras, I chose Loose Ends because it came from a very popular radio programme, Ned Sherrin's. And I knew Ned Sherrin well, and I felt that I wanted to do justice to his memory. In the book, I have got chapters on the First World War, which I still call the Great War. I think it's very different from the Second World War. And I found that writing that chapter was immensely interesting. And my son very kindly drove me over to the Somme under the tunnel, which I'd never been under before. And when I got to the other side, I recognised at once all kinds of places which I had seen when I was a boy. Because I first went there in 1934, which is an immensely long time ago now. And I stayed in a house by the sea at a place which nobody knows called Ult, which is on the Channel coast. And I looked back at the holidays that I spent there with the family with whom I stayed. And I'm all in favour of real family visits and not just getting involved in a school party going on a trip.
A proper exchange.
Yes. I found Ult most interesting, and I'm very glad that my son took me there. And we had the best oysters as I'd had for a long time, and I love oysters. I haven't really changed my tastes or my views all that much since I was at Bletchley. I learnt a lot from Bletchley, and it taught me about bringing people from diverse backgrounds and diverse subjects together. And I think it's a pity to concentrate too much on the mathematicians. I think the historians played an absolutely basic part here, because it was part of my job as a historian to be able to get inside the mind of the person who sent a message. And that is a very necessary help to cryptography. I think we were very good crib breakers through the way in which we interested ourselves in the people who were sending the messages. And I got deeply interested in messages coming from the Balkans. And I found that those messages taught me a great deal about Tito and his opponents. And they introduced me to Bill Deakin, who was a very remarkable man and a good friend of mine, with whom I remained in touch for the rest of my life. And Deakin got me involved in writing for Winston Churchill's History of the English People. And I was not allowed to publish anything about that, but I've discovered some of the bits which I kept. And when I got a cheque from Churchill for writing these comments and a letter of thanks, I hesitated for a very long time about whether to cash the cheque. I needed the money, so I cashed it.
Wasn't it Tommy Cooper or someone used to sign cheques to people, knowing that people yes. would never cash them because yes. they've basically got his autograph?
I feel myself that I should have kept it, but I was offered more in that cheque than I was paid in a year by my college.
It's nice that you equate the eccentricities of the house to the people yes. as well, I think. I think that's one of the things that I always see. I think of this really strange-looking house with all its different
yes.
styles of architecture, and it's like you say, it's different disciplines. It was the linguists, it was the historians, yes. the mathematicians. It was that mix of people that really made this place work, wasn't it?
They did, and in this very building, there were people who came across and did the Times crossword puzzle in their lunch break. And I thought they were unbelievable.
Have you had an opportunity to see the new huts yet?
Yes.
What did you think of them?
I thought they're very fascinating. They've got, apparently, the colours, but of course I never saw them in those colours myself. I arrived just after Block D
yes.
was completed. And there I had a very interesting 2 years, because we were there for D-Day, and I was very much an admirer of the man who ran the watch in Hut 6, John Manistee, who had been at Marlborough, which was a school which sent a lot of people here. And after the end of the war, he became a housemaster at Winchester. So I used to go and stay with him in Winchester. And of course, he's one of the few people I could talk to about intelligence. My wife knew nothing about. People would occasionally say to me, what was it like in Hut 6? Or, do you ever go back to Hut 6? And she'd say, what is Hut 6? I couldn't really properly tell her. I wasn't really bound by secrecy because of the sign, the Official Secrets Act. I believed myself that it was very important not to give away what we'd been doing, because it was important to winning the war. And I was a bit uneasy when people began to write about the secrets of Bletchley, to tell the truth, even long after the event. By that time, I had actually told my wife that I'd been breaking codes at Bletchley. And also, we went to Woburn Abbey several times. And I met people there I'd known when political intelligence was in Woburn Abbey. I knew rather more of that during the war than most people who were working at Bletchley.
How did you feel when Winterbottom's book came out?
Well, I thought it was a good thing that it came out, but I think it was a very bad book and full of mistakes.
Yes, obviously, there's a Coventry myth has grown yes, from that yes. book, hasn't it?
And also, he didn't understand the bomb. He didn't really understand anything, to my mind, about the way that Bletchley really worked. I did know Ronald Lewin very well, and I did feel that by the time he was writing, I could really talk to him about Bletchley. And I knew him very well through the BBC. I never expected, of course, I should say, when I was here, that there would be an open university in Milton Keynes.
Well, when you were here, it was a tiny village, wasn't it?
It was a tiny village. I did know Newport Pagnell very well, and various bits and pieces of what has become Milton Keynes complex. But I find that when I go round the district now, places come to my mind. And I do remember we didn't have to do much military work when I was at Bletchley, but I do remember very clearly on one or two marches seeing all the blackthorn out in all its beauty, and I'd never seen any blackthorn in the north of England where I was born. so that even the landscape around Bletchley, with about enormous numbers of brick chimneys, really was a change for me.
Thank you so much.
Well, glad to
do it. Some lovely memories there as well.
Yes.
Thank you very much, sir.
Well, good to
do it. Thank you for your service.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, where we are at BPark Podcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.